Hardly a day goes by without someone declaring the answer to the federal government's persistent cybersecurity problems. Two-factor authentication, biometrics, encryption. But nothing's perfect. Dr. Christopher Bainan is a senior program manager at the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA. He joins me now with some cautionary thinking. And Chris, you have talked a lot about this in different forums. What is the latest thinking and what is really a best practice for authentication of users outside of the good old-fashioned password, which we all know has got to go?
Sure. So I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, best practice is very highly depending upon your application. So what you want to do to protect your, you know, Farmville game is probably going to be different than what the government may use for high security installations. So I'm used to more dealing with the high security types of concerns. And there, what I'd recommend is some form of ID card, whether that has a chip in it or not, a PIN or a password, depending upon, you know, the system you're using, a biometric, and a human security presence. Now, obviously, all of those things are overkill, depending upon, you know, what exactly it is that you're doing. But when used in conjunction, each one of those elements provides a unique orthogonal aspect of identity authentication that is harder for someone to bypass.
Now, the CIO of the Defense Department, Terry Halverson, says it's time to start thinking about phasing out the CAC, the Common Access Card, and I guess by extension, maybe the HSPD-12 card, because of the card form factor itself. Is there a way of getting the card functionality without the card?
So I'm not necessarily the best person to talk specifically about that, say, card style. But, you know, what I'll say is there's always a variety of ways of doing these things. And, you know, I really do think it depends upon your, you know, given approach.
Well, I think what people want to do is take whatever is in cards of all sorts, even credit cards for that matter, and get it into a mobile instance on a phone. I mean, is that doable with security?
Well, one of the unique challenges the government has is that we have a lot of facilities where usage of a mobile phone is problematic. And so, you know, mobile phones...
Like a lot of federal agencies, like the intelligence community.
Sure. We have, you know, facilities where you wouldn't be taking a mobile phone in or out.
All those little lockers outside there.
Right, right. And so, you know, mobile phones may be problematic in, you know, as a solution there. But I think what is interesting that is related to mobile phones is we're more and more starting to think about, say, temporal geotagging as an element of authentication.
And what is that?
Well, if you think of it, this is really something that the credit card industry has used to combat fraud for years. It's the concept of your card can't be in two places at once. So, you know, If your card is having charges in Washington, D.C. and Paris, France within an hour of each other, physics dictates that the card probably didn't get between those two locations at once, right? And so there, you know, the credit card industry would, you know, flag your account. That's when you have to call them now, say where you are, and, you know, deal with it. You know, and there's no reason we can't use similar concepts for authentication, right? Mobile phones are a unique way to try and, you know, track where we are in time and space. And so, you know, if your mobile phone is in one location and you are credentialing in another, that's a sign that there may be a problem.
And is this type of functionality, this comparison, is that available as a kind of commercial functionality that you can buy?
Well, in a limited capacity, it's actually used commercially, say, for certain websites you access. For myself, every time I log into a different machine or location for my online banking, right, it'll ask me to do extra authentication steps.
Like your zip code or...
Well, so let's assume I use a new computer in a new location. What they'll want to do is it initiates a two-factor authentication process. So normally when I log in, my password is sufficient. But if they see me logging in from a new location, they want to make sure that, you know, it's really me versus someone who's stolen my credentials. And so they then want to do some form of, you know, two-factor authentication where, you know, they send me a unique code via an agreed upon communications medium, whether that's email, text, phone, and then I have to enter it into the system.
We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Bainan, a senior program manager in the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects activity. And while we're using 50 cent words, you also have talked about the idea of homomorphic encryption.
So homomorphic encryption is fascinating, and I think it's going to do a lot for privacy and security in the future. we talk a lot about end-to-end encryption when dealing with things like the internet or a network. And the idea there is that the data becomes encrypted before it leaves the machine that it's coming from. It transmits over the network in an encrypted fashion, and it's not unencrypted until it gets where it's going. And the advantage of that is that during that period of transmission, if anyone were to see the data, they couldn't make use of it, right? It'd be gibberish. Homomorphic encryption is about trying to do a similar process for the entire life of the data as it's computed on, you know, on a machine. So
data at rest, in other words.
At rest or in processing. Mm-hmm. So as an example, you can imagine a human resource application where someone may want to pull up statistics on salary relating to things like demographics, time in company, position, you know, all these factors. And in the process of compiling all that information, you'd be accessing fairly sensitive PII. And the person who's trying to, you know, run this calculation really doesn't need to know any individual specific information, right? They just need the end result. But under the traditional computing model, what would have to happen is your database, even if it was encrypted at rest, has to get unencrypted, loaded into memory, processed on, and then, you know, the result returned. But that means that other than when your data is at rest, it's vulnerable, right? Anybody can see it in its plain text on the machine. Homomorphic encryption tries to make sure that the data is encrypted during that entire process so that you couldn't just read the RAM and get the raw data, right? So you don't get the unencrypted answer until you've actually finished the computation. So this is really interesting from a data set perspective, from an insider threat perspective. You know, are people accessing you know, what they should? And it's particularly interesting for a cloud computing environment where our data all tends to commingle on a common machine.
So that means the encryption then is almost a quality of the data itself, regardless of what state it's in or where it is.
Correct. Yeah. So the data stays encrypted the entire time.
And what does that do to the computing resources required to work with it?
So you've now identified the drawback of homomorphic encryption. And I should point out, while it's been, you know, theoretically a concept for a long time, you know, its first practical implementations really started coming out around 2009. So the first practical implementation from Craig Gentry at IBM, who, by the way, won a MacArthur Genius Grant Award for his work, a simple operation like addition was 100 trillion times slower within this homomorphic encryption model. So, you know, that's 14 zeros.
So it would take 100 years to add up 2 plus 2.
Well, actually, it took 30 minutes. So it
that's
would
long
take
enough.
Him, it'd take him 30 minutes. But, you know, the average computer operation, right, like an addition, I mean, there's lots of those for anything you want to do. So obviously, you know, at that speed, that's a challenge. On top of the fact that, you know, the math involved here is extremely complex. You know, this is a much more complex setup than traditional. But, you know, by 2014, Craig Gentry's implementation had gotten down to a million times slower. So that goes from 14 zeros to 6 zeros. That's a huge improvement. Now, a million times is still a lot slower. But he's projecting that by 2020, it will start to be practically useful for applications.
So agencies shouldn't go out looking for this to buy it now.
No, this is advanced long-term technology. There are no commercial packages to buy. And, you know, even from a theoretical perspective, we're not ready to roll it out.
And what are some of the emerging limitations on biometrics? Because you hear a lot about those, and they all have their drawbacks too. What are some of them?
Yeah, sure. So the biggest limitation is one of biometric strengths. It just happens to have a drawback, which is the permanence. So if you get your identity stolen, you can go to the legal system, get a new social security number. If you get your fingerprints stolen, we can't do anything for you. Your fingerprints are your fingerprints. But at the same token, that's exactly why we like biometrics, right? Because they're permanent, they're unique to you. So as we look at biometrics, you know, what's new is as they become used more, we're seeing more practical examples of how criminals are exploiting them, but this isn't new, right? John Dillinger back in the 1920s was removing fingerprints via acid and techniques like that. What's new are things like in 2005, an owner of an S-Class Mercedes got his finger chopped off so they could steal the Mercedes, right? So as we use these new technologies, they become threatened, exploited, attacked more.
And also, can't the biometric be expressed as a digital element, which is then available for theft or purloining,
and
then
just
reuse that way?
Once your fingerprint is compromised, how do you get a new one? Now, but actually, that's something that we're working on at IARPA. I've got a program called ODIN, and it's focused on detecting presentation attacks. So presentation attacks are when you would have stolen somebody's biometric, and you would be attempting to, you know, utilize that biometric fraudulently, or perhaps just being avoiding yourself being identified.
Well, and couldn't you use the same technique as with the geospacing issue?
So certainly that's another way that you could try and combat people using biometrics fraudulently.
Your thumb can't be in Paris while your credit card is in New York.
Absolutely. And so that's part of a more comprehensive system you can do. But what we're focusing on in this program is actually trying to make sure that when the sample is fraudulent, the sensor and algorithms can determine that the sample is fraudulent when it's captured.
There's no flesh and blood behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, for years, some sensors have chosen to look for oxygenated hemoglobin as a indicator that a sample is one, alive, so, you know, for the guy who got his finger chopped off, you couldn't use it once you chopped it off, and two, authentic. And this is really important because to make a fraudulent fingerprint is not that hard. You know, a quick YouTube search, $10 and Woody...
And some gummy bears, right?
Yeah, and some gummy bears, some Silly Putty and wood glue, and you're off to the races. So what we want to make sure, though, and there's good indications that we're going to be successful, is that when people try to use these fraudulent devices or approaches, that the system can determine that the sample is fraudulent and just not accept it or reject it. What's particularly challenging is that we're trying to detect both known and unknown presentation attacks. And that's really important from a security perspective because known presentation attacks, you know, things that we know people are doing, like the Silly Putty and wood glue, are really easy to look for. But, you know, the bad guys don't tend to tell us all the bad stuff they're doing. And if you only look for what you know is bad, you're going to miss a whole lot of stuff that isn't. So the focus of this new program we have is really on trying to have intelligent systems that can identify unknown attacks that they've never seen before.
It's almost like the way the Treasury Department tries to keep on top of counterfeiters, and they change the composition of the bills and the paper used to make them every sometimes within a matter of a couple of years.
That's a great analogy. We are absolutely looking for counterfeit biometric samples. That's one way of thinking of it. And interestingly, some of the technology we're developing may long-term be applicable to other forms of counterfeit, whether they be bills, concert tickets, who knows what the case may be.
We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Bainan, a senior program manager in the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects activity. And a lot of agencies are using something called the challenge question, very common technique in commercial. Now more agencies, I think the IRS might even be trying that. I think the GOES system at Customs and Border Protection has that when you enroll and so forth. But what are the challenges of those, though, where they ask you, you know, your mother's maiden name or the color of the car you bought 3 years ago, that kind of thing?
Sure. So, you know, the challenge with that is that they're trying to use that as a password that it's easier for you to remember, right? Because you already know your mother's maiden name, the last four digits of your social security number, whatever the case may be. And so in one sense, it's an attractive model. The problem with it is these are facts about you that someone else could potentially unearth. This actually happened with Sarah Palin back in 2008. A 20-year-old college student who had never met Sarah Palin managed to find the answers to all of her questions and break into her Yahoo email account. So, you know, the risk here is that these are passwords that someone, you know, could much more easily guess. Now, at first glance, it might seem like if you would move towards, say, preference questions versus, you know, biographic questions that are looked up, you know, it'd be harder to guess, right? But just as an example, you know, what's your favorite color? 85% of people, their favorite color is blue, green, purple, red, or black. So, you know, the more, you know, this is just an example that the more you try to make these generalizable questions, the easier it is for someone to break into them. In the case of what we would call brute force password attacks, right, what you're doing here is defining a much more succinct, smaller dictionary to use in attacking those questions.
So if you used color, say, and car model, even mm-hmm. every car model ever made in history, mm-hmm. Is still not that very big a database in terms of what some of these cracking programs can do.
Exactly. So, you know, if you look at law enforcement, when they try to crack a criminal's password, you know, what they'll try to do, they won't have this great information like the password prompt was car model. But what they tend to do are things like, he's a guy who likes guns. So they go and they load a dictionary of a whole bunch of gun terms, gun models, you know, and then during the brute force process, you know, assuming his password had something to do with that, it becomes much easier for them to guess.
And let's finish up with the old-fashioned password, which we know all of the abuse mechanisms that users have for passwords, is a really strong password still an effective device for cybersecurity? Say you have one of those random generators that has something you can't even possibly remember, mm-hmm. unless you write it down and give it out. Is that still superior to
bad password? Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's worth remembering that there's all sorts of factors that can affect that security, right? One, are you using the same password multiple places? So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg recently got several of his accounts compromised. And one, it's bad security practice on his part. He was using the same password multiple places. But it also turns out that one of the sources of his password was somebody who was storing passwords in plain text. So what that means is traditionally what you should do in best practice is you take a password, you kind of encrypt it. We would call it a hash, but you encrypt it. And then what you store is not the raw password. So that in your database, if your database got compromised, you couldn't use that password if you used the same one somewhere else and go try it somewhere else. So one, in his case, a company had handled that incorrectly, right? One risk is you use the same password multiple places. Another risk is how often do you change your password, right? The more often you change it, the more secure you are. But at some point, you know, as a security guy, I can make you change your password once a day, make it be 50 random characters. But what's probably going to happen is you're going to write it on a sticky note and put it under your monitor, which obviously is the opposite of what we want security-wise. So there's a trade-off that we have to have between, how long a password is, how often do we make you change it, you know, just from a practical perspective. And once again, depending upon your application, maybe you never need to change it. You know, that's all something that's got to be considered. But randomly generated passwords are a very secure aspect to authentication.
Dr. Christopher Bainan is a cybersecurity program manager at the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click share with friends.